into a showing of a new rom-com. I know, he says, and I drop it. I'm still trying to find the balance between advocating for myself and not being a nag. At 35, most men have children. If they are decent human beings, they take care of those children. And this means that children and their economic and relational needs are always the priority. Like me, Mike grew up without his dad. And like so many black men who grew up with the structural shame of the Moynihan Report and its denigration of absentee black fathers, Mike is trying to be super dad. For my part, I feel a mix of admiration and jealousy. This is the first time I am witnessing up close a man making the sacrifices to be a present father. I only knew what it looked like watching my mother do it. I bring up this super dad thing to Mike as we are leaving a showing of Southside With You, a movie that I loved because of the romance and that he loved because he's a Barack stan. We are discussing the scene where Michelle implores Barack to forgive his father for abandoning him. I know Mike has all the sensitive spots about his father having left him as a child. But since movies are, I am hoping, a great way to broach relationship topics that are hard to discuss, I dive in. It's interesting that brothers our age who didn't have fathers have tried to overcompensate for it with their own kids by becoming super dads, I tell him. It's interesting because the lesson you learn from your father's leaving is that you should be better, more dedicated fathers. But none of you thinks anything about learning to be better partners. He looks at me questioningly. What do you mean? Well, the reason your fathers left is often because they didn't know or care to learn how to be good partners to your mothers. I just find it interesting that for a whole generation of you, y'all don't ever think critically about what you should do differently about the partnership piece. So many brothers still resent the mothers of their children, but they insist on being fathers regardless. He says, I'll have to think about it. And I let the conversation drop, because giving a Patriarchy 101 lecture on date night would be tantamount to cock-blocking myself, and this good feminist still needs dick. To put it how Maya Angelou once defined feminism, it'd be stupid not to be on my own side. But it occurs to me, as I feign flexibility in the face of canceled dates because of the kids and a reduction in date nights because of economic pressures, that I have no idea how it feels to be a man's number one priority. After the love was gone, my daddy left too. And now that I'm dating someone else's daddy, insisting that my needs come first is selfish. But for the first time in my life, I'm at least on the list of priorities. My happiness and my needs are a consideration. This is what I tell my therapist, that what I want more than anything is to know what it feels like to be a consideration. Mike laps at my big girl body and grabs my booty like he's been waiting all his life to find it. That counts for something, too. Black men's cultural anxiety about the place of money in relationships is real and palpable. Another brother I dated once asked me, "What do you want in a relationship?" Well, I told him with an S on my chest, "I don't need a man to give me money or pay my rent or buy me things. I can do that myself." "What do you want then?" he asked, rather testily. "I want a partner, someone who shows up for me, offers emotional support, and someone to share my life with." "Oh," he said with no hint of irony, "you want me to be gay." This is why we can't have nice things. Black men's refusal to own their feelings about how capitalism, patriarchy, and white supremacy leave them shit out of luck on the regular does more harm than good. Scapegoating gay brothers because the hetero patriarchy ain't trying to help straight brothers come up is not the move. And when projecting vulnerability onto gay men doesn't work, too many brothers heap their fear, anxiety, and resentment on black women. Kanye made millions blaming black women for desiring men to have some level of economic stability. This anxiety about unstable economic prospects is not new. Black women have been talking about the ways black men show their asses about this since the 1940s. In 1947, Pauli Murray, a famous civil rights attorney, wrote an article in Negro Digest titled, "Why Negro Girls Stay Single." She lamented that education was, quote, a social handicap if the educated woman wanted marriage. But men didn't date educated women, Murray asserted, because it would be too great a threat to their security. Patriarchy had made black men feel like they should be, quote, the lords of creation, the breadwinners and warriors of our time and all time. But given economic realities that limited educational and economic opportunities, the men of Murray's day were mostly stunting while trying to cover up the fact that they were as frightened and insecure as modern women are. Fear can distort your view of the facts. Despite the fact that black women outpace black men educationally, black men still have far more net wealth than black women do. The way patriarchy is set up, men always have more wealth and social status. And this means that marriage has long been the path to economic stability for women of all races. Yet, it is Black women who get branded as welfare queens by the government and as gold-digging baby mamas by Black men. At some point, brothers gotta own their shit here. They have to own their fear. They have to own that they have always gauged their nearness to patriarchal dominance by measuring both how far beneath white men they fall and how far above Black women they rise. Sisters climbing the social ladder is scary for so many brothers, but it doesn't have to be. About 10 years ago, independent self-supporting women were in vogue in Black popular culture. Everyone from rapper Webby to R&B singers Ne-Yo and Jamie Foxx released odes to the independent woman, whom they loved and celebrated because she didn't need a man and had her own money. These brothers seemed to be rejecting Kanye West's anxiety by celebrating the fact that a woman who got her own didn't need so much from them. It was a useful intervention, albeit brief. Most brothers I encountered were deeply suspicious of independent women. One brother I dated sat on my couch one night denigrating all you independent don't need a man types. When I pointed out the contradiction of hating women who were independent and hating women who were gold diggers, and therefore by definition too dependent, all I got was a Kanye shrug. When I was a kid and an angsty teen nerd experiencing my first crushes and my first loves, I believed that Black men loved Black women. If the love songs my mama played on the stereo on Saturday evenings were any indicator, they saw us as gorgeous, magical, and worthy of their best ploys to win our affections. Whether I was listening to my mama's old Luther Vandross tapes or playing Boys to Men songs on repeat, I understood what it meant for men to profess their love for women in their music. They sang about sex, too. But they also sang about heartbreak, betrayal, unrequited love, and the joy of falling in love. In high school, I lived for the moments when my crushes asked me to slow dance at parties. By the time I reached my late 20s, slow dancing had gone the way of the rotary phone, and love songs had turned into male bitch fest. There is a decided difference between Carl Thomas singing, "I Wish I Never Met Her at All," and Chris Brown singing, "These hoes ain't loyal." Sometimes I wish I could ask Black men, "What did we do to make you hate us so much?" I know I sound old, begging for love songs and slow dances. Perhaps I'm asking too much to demand emotional vulnerability and maturity from Black men, and at least a smidgen of integrity from those brothers who have access to cultural and religious pulpits. But can we tell the truth about it? Is there a way to say, without sounding like somebody's grandma, that 3 decades of turning the disrespect of Black women into a global art form via hip-hop might have some intimate and emotional cost for Black folks? Is there a way to do that without letting white supremacy off the hook for creating the very social conditions that caused these problems in the first place? Where did all this resentment come from? What did Black women ever do to warrant this level of hatred? Where the fuck is the love? It's seriously so much easier to just blame Bill Clinton. Late one night, I trekked to Harlem for a series of emotional justice conversations that my good friend Esther Arma hosted in an attempt to get Black women and men to be vulnerable with each other in pursuit of mutual healing. I listened to a bunch of ostensibly in-touch together brothers dialogue about their feelings, hurts, and traumas, and the ways that the failure to think this through in relationships had caused them to do harm to various women. Like many sisters, I sat in the audience all in my feelings, grateful for once that maybe there were a few brothers out there willing to share the weight and do some of the emotional labor of building strong Black relationships. Still, the audience that night was 90% Black women. There's no justice in that. There can be no justice when brothers fail to show up to have the tough conversations. There are a few critical shifts that I think we can make that will move us closer together. First, we need to pursue intimate solidarity with one another. Solidarity and allyship matter as much in the bedroom as they matter in the revolution. Hip-hop generation brothers love to talk about how their ideal mates are ride-or-die chicks who are down for anything. If there is at all a healthy or just version of ride-or-die Black relationships, it is rooted in the concept of being allies and co-conspirators. It is rooted in a notion of partnership and solidarity. The way we love each other, or fail to, is a life-and-death situation. Black families and Black communities can't thrive without love and abundance. We need intimate solidarity with one another. Method Man said it this way in the original Ride or Die anthem. "You're all that I need. I'll be there for you. If you keep it real with me, I'll keep it real with you." This is what intimate solidarity and just Black love look like. Acknowledging that we need each other. Committing to showing up for each other. And committing to radical honesty and realness with each other. Second, black men have to stop heaping all of their anger and resentment over the way that patriarchy has failed them on the backs of black women. Far too many brothers conceptualize freedom as the sharing of power with white men. And every time a bid for power fails, it is sisters who get shit upon and who are asked to pick up the broken pieces. This has to change. More to the point, if you feel like your manhood is rooted in failure, how can you possibly love yourself? So much of the discourse of the failure of black intimacy is about the ways that black women just need to love themselves. But when we look more closely, very often it is brothers who are oozing wounds of self-hatred and low self-esteem. Any man who treats women as ornamental clearly believes that outward decoration will hide inner deficiency. They have therapists for that. Third, straight black men have to stop letting homophobia and misogyny impede healthy possibilities for love. Seeing the desire for partnership as gay is teenage boy logic, and it should have no place in the emotional lives of grown men. Homophobia and misogyny will be the death of black love. Being vulnerable doesn't make one gay or straight, and continuing to invest in a view of romantic relationships that is set up for black folks to lose isn't especially smart. When black love succeeds in a system that hates us all, there is something profoundly queer about that. Queer black folks have survived precisely because they have refused to let traditional ideas about what love and relationships should look like dictate what is possible for them. Partnership and all of the practices that are necessary to achieve it disrupt the social hierarchies that currently structure black intimacy. Partnership demands that we meet each other on equal footing. Partnership stops placing the entire onus on black men to profess, protect, and provide. That's too much weight to carry. We all need someone to speak up for us, to look out for us, and to share resources to help us make it. We bring all our strengths and our weaknesses to the table. We agree that no matter what, we ride for each other. We decide that we are co-conspirators in a project of black love. We agree to do the work we need to do to be together. We center a justice practice as a love language. We commit to being intimately and relationally just with one another. If my grandmother could see this lay of the land, I think she would say, "You young folks study yourselves way too much." In other words, we overthink everything and take it all so deadly seriously. We have to figure out how to commit to the fierce pursuit of joy with one another. There was a boy whom I thought I loved, a Southern country boy intellectual, who seemed like the prototype of the kind of man I thought I should marry. Randy was the kind of dude who could quote black feminist theorists like bell hooks and Patricia Hill Collins off the dome. We were intellectual kindred spirits. He had a reputation for being a ladies' man, though, and once when we were honest enough to joke about it, he said to me, "I'm a feminist. I love women." During one conversation in the spring of 2008, when it looked like Barack Obama would have a real chance of clinching the Democratic nomination, I had lunch with Randy. He said, "I don't understand why Michelle Obama hasn't quit her job yet." Looking curiously at him, I asked, "Well, why would she? He isn't the nominee yet." And in the parlance of a church boy, he said, "Yes, but surely it's time for her to get fully on board with his vision." In that moment, I knew that while Randy was a feminist intellectually, his first impulse emotionally was to expect a high-powered career woman like Michelle Obama to quit her job to support her husband going after his dreams. That wasn't feminist. Lots of men have feminist rhetoric down, but many of them haven't done the emotional work of showing up for a woman with dreams and visions of her own. I learned in that moment that marrying a feminist dude wasn't the goal. Instead, I learned to look for men who genuinely like and value women as people. Years later, though, I saw the girl Randy did marry, a lovely woman with a career of her own who prioritized supporting his career. None of this surprised me. But the thing I also discovered was that she made him laugh uproariously on the regular. I realized that even though my assessments about the legitimacy of his feminist politics were right and our intellectual kinship mattered, in the end, he chose a partner with whom he could find unadulterated joy. And in this, too, is a lesson. Given the hard realities that black folks face in finding their way to one another, black love is nothing if it is not simultaneously a conduit to black joy. The lessons seem to be: find someone who makes you laugh. Find someone who doesn't allow you to take yourself too seriously. Find someone who brings you joy. And please, please, bring back slow dancing. Favor ain't fair. Survivor's guilt shows up in a really odd way among black radical intellectuals. The ongoing narrative in black social justice and academic spaces is that working class black neighborhoods, the hood, the ghetto, the projects, are revolutionary. One activist told me during a training for organizers that it was the job of black professionals, those of us who had made it, to return to live in the hood. I lived for 4 of my first 5 years in the projects. I remember it. And while the projects in the small town South are not at all comparable to the horror stories I hear coming out of urban ghettos, I have no intention of returning, and I don't have any guilt about it. The activist who insisted that I should want to return is himself first-generation middle class. His parents grew up in the hood, and he suffered from a serious case of FOMO. His solution was that we should all, therefore, return. I, on the other hand, witnessed exactly what the daily grind looked like for my mother, who had the nerve to have middle-class aspirations as she slowly, methodically worked her way from a place in the projects to a modest apartment to a house. When I was about 4, my mom, dad, and I went to the A&P grocery store. My mom, still in her work clothes, looked bone-tired. As the groceries sailed down the conveyor belt, my dad stood at the other end. When time came to pay, only my mother reached for her wallet. I looked at Daddy, expecting, thinking, waiting on him to contribute. He looked at me sheepishly, almost shrugging, as my mother paid for the groceries alone. Why hadn't my daddy helped my mommy? In the months to come, Daddy bounced, strutting out of the door one sunny morning with a white towel slung over the shoulder of his bare torso, after my mother summoned the courage to tell him, "It's over." He left without incident, refusing even to catch my eye as I sat on the sofa, witnessing his exit. I asked my mother what motivated her to want to get out of the projects, even though all her friends still lived there. She said simply, "I saw people going to sleep all around me. I wanted better for you." Concentrated poverty meant that seeing ambulances and hearing police sirens were a regular occurrence. One evening, one of my mama's friends showed up holding a bloody T-shirt in a bag. Her brother had been stabbed, and though he would be fine, she had gone to the hospital to collect his belongings. I knew her brother, and I was horrified to see the bloody contents of that bag dangling from her hands while she stood in our living room. There is often little peace and quiet and even less space to think when violence can show up in your living room at any given time. I told the young activist who began to belligerently insist on his revolutionary hood housing program that asking black women to move back into violent, under-resourced spaces didn't seem particularly revolutionary to me. His revolution was rooted in a male-centered conception of men politicking in the ghetto. But black women's revolutions are always about safety, food, and education for women, children, and the elderly. No matter where the sisters are, we are always making meals, raising children, and keeping things together. When we do make it out in the simple hopes that it will be a little easier to keep things together now. Guilting black folks, particularly black women, for pursuing safety, care, and possibility for their children is not a freedom project. When my mother announced casually while putting away laundry in our apartment, "We're getting a house," I jumped on her back, hugging her, shrieking for joy. This was a big deal, even though she was playing it cool. When we pulled up to the house, I vaguely remembered that I had seen Chip Brown, the little brother of Tammy Brown, the girl who had called me nigger, peering out from the screen door of this very house the year before when my school bus passed through the neighborhood. After they had moved out, my mother's realtor had come and cried, she told my mother, over the mess they'd made of the place. On the Saturdays leading up to our move, I helped wash the walls at our new house while Mama climbed on the kitchen counters, unscrewed all the old cabinets, stripped the old varnish from them, and replaced it with a shiny new coat. During breaks, I rolled my 8-year-old body on the new blue carpet, thinking it felt so nice compared to the dingy brown carpet in the apartment we were leaving. Those were the triumphs, but the stress showed up too, in the form of my mother's perpetually upset stomach, her painful and chronic ingrown toenails that there was no money to fix, and the kind of strictness that occurs when you don't have time for your child to do anything but toe the line. My mother believed in old school parenting, which meant she didn't believe it was her job to entertain me. "That is why you have a room full of books and toys," she would pointedly remind me every time I complained too much about being bored. Getting Mama to play board games with me, or to let me play in her hair and call her by her first name, were treats reserved for special days. I became an exceptional student because it was the only job I had. My mother went to work to make a life for us, and I went to school and made A's. A's made my mother proud, and I was a classic overachieving only child, deeply adult-identified and invested in keeping my mother happy. getting A's was not rewarded. That was the expectation. When it became clear to my community, family members, teachers, church congregation, that I was an exceptionally smart child, the refrain of my interactions with these adults became, "Get your lesson, girl. Keep your head in them books. If you put God first, you can go anywhere and be anything." I loved all the positive attention and brought home all the A's I could to keep it going. Being singled out as exceptional by the adults at home and school created its own set of problems among my peers. I became a target of other black children in the community who accused me of talking too proper and acting white. From their vantage point, I was trying to be special and different in ways that either they could not be or did not want to be. One Saturday, two girls from down the street came to visit. We weren't friends entirely, but we were cool. It was almost as if Dominique and Tracy had been given a dare to come knock on my door and see what would happen. I let them in and took them to my very girly room with the pink and blue doll wallpaper and peach bedspread, the Barbie dolls and Babysitter's Club books, the notebooks and papers where I played school with said dolls strewn about. Out of sheer Southern politeness, we engaged in banal chatter, with it all feeling entirely odd to me. These girls were not my friends. Why were they at my house? Finally, after this performance had gone on for a few minutes, Dominique looked at me with pity and said, "You really do want to be white, don't you?" "Well, no," I stumbled, taken aback, offering a none-too-impressive response. Dominique humored me, nodding as I talked. She still thought I was weird, though. They had caught me at home on a weekend in a place where I wasn't used to being attacked. At school, where my guard was always up, when I was taunted, I usually shouted back, "Does being smart make you white?" Witty retorts were not my specialty. After a few more minutes of awkwardness, Dominique and Tracy left. Meanwhile, an opportunity to connect with some black girls for friends had slipped away yet again. I sat in my room wondering what was wrong with the kind of black girl I chose to be, and also thinking they were supremely ignorant for believing that a love of books and standard English meant I wanted to be white. Year upon year of being called white only strengthened my resolve for an exit strategy. My mother hated that I was so bothered. She came home and talked to me about an article she had read that said we all have different ways of talking depending on the audience. I eagerly sucked up this information, hoping that I didn't secretly really want to be white. But somehow, other black girls didn't recognize the Tevin Campbell and Boys to Men loving black girl in me. On particularly bad days, my mama would give me the black mama pep talk. "Those kids ain't about nothing. You stay focused. And if you keep on living, one of these days, you'll see how they turn out versus how you turn out." She was right, of course. Our paths were largely set by the time we were nine. My teacher, Miss Galden, one of only a very few black teachers that I had, insisted that I be tested for the Gifted and Talented program. When the results came in and she was told that I had failed, she insisted that they rescore my test. They had, in fact, made an error. I was indeed gifted and talented and therefore worthy of small special classes and extracurricular experiences. Many of my classmates, especially those without benefit of Miss Galden, received no such special care, cultivation, or opportunities. Many of those children continued to labor under the assumption that white people, and we blacks who supposedly wanted to be white, had a monopoly on smartness. Nothing about our deeply segregated school system ever challenged their ideas. And of course, my weak retorts to the daily taunts did not ever rise to the level of a piercing systemic critique. I came to believe that I was special, unique, and exceptional. Of course, I wanted to be among smart black overachieving kids. This is why I set out for Howard at the first opportunity. But making it out of Ruston, Louisiana meant that I had to believe the lie of my own exceptionalism, that my classmates had fewer opportunities because they didn't try hard enough and because they were trying to be too cool for school. At one point in high school, my god sister April joined in on taunting me. We had grown up together, my mother the best of friends with her mother and her aunts. April grew up in the old projects while I lived a few blocks away in the new projects. The only thing that really distinguished them was that the new projects had lighter bricks and metal screen doors, while the old projects had wooden ones. By high school, April had her crew and I had mine. No one knew we had grown up as damn near kin, that we used to sleep in the same bed together while the adults went down to a club called the Limb to dance the night away. One aunt always stayed behind and threatened us late into the night, telling us, "Take your asses to bed before I come in there and whoop somebody." On this day, I watched as April giggled at me as other girls, her friends, tossed barbs my way, berating everything from the way I talked to my long straight hair. She need a perm, one of them taunted as April giggled. During my daily debriefing with my mother, I mentioned that some girls at school said I needed a perm. They're just jealous, my mother said. Back then, I had an enviable head of long, thick black girl hair that was great for styling, but I was mostly oblivious to it since I much preferred to have my head in a book than in a stylist chair. I mentioned the names of the girls taunting me, thinking nothing of including April. It had been years since we'd spent weekends having sleepovers while our parents were out on the town. My mother called her aunt and told it. And April, I heard, got the dressing down of her life as every single auntie let her know that not only do you not need to be picking on Brittany, but you need to be trying to do what she doing. Apparently, being fussed out was effective. The very next time this scenario went on in the hallway, I looked her in the eye, anticipating the barbs, but she was curiously, noticeably silent. I was relieved. I hadn't really planned to rat her out, but I appreciated the affirmation that the adults in her life gave me. You need to be doing what Brittany is doing. Being excluded and being exceptional are the frequent prerequisites for a bad case of self-righteousness. Because I was a classic good girl, I naturally thought myself more devout and more godly than my classmates, and when that is combined with an evangelical orientation to the world, it's a problem. I approached knowing God the same way I approached getting A's. Follow the rules and success will come to you. The more I excelled, the more I chalked it up to God's blessing and favor on my life. Black church folks love to talk about how blessed and highly favored they are. It is the kind of explanation that comes to stand in far too often for structural inequality. Favor ain't fair, or so the saying goes. So I came to understand my success in that way too. In my early 20s, a preacher at my local church went so far as to prophesy blessings of God's favor over my life. I had been put here to make a special impact, he pronounced one evening during a Bible study class. Here's the thing. I'm still a Christian, so I will never discount God's favor and the way it has shown up in my life. This is a challenge for mainstream feminism because much of it is still a deeply secular project. So many black women I know, even those who don't go to church very much, still have deep spiritual and religious lives. Most black feminists I know have some version of a God concept. For those of us who watched our mamas work themselves damn near to death to raise up powerful daughters like us, attributing it to sheer strength of will and hard work is an American fable that doesn't suit us. Liberal white folks tell themselves these kinds of stories, that they made it because of their own ingenuity and will. But most black girls have enough humility to see ourselves as walking miracles who, as Audre Lorde famously said, were never meant to survive. I want to be clear that God has a place in how I think about justice and feminism, but I hate God explanations for structural problems. I learned the limits of these kinds of explanations clearly when I returned to reckon with my old classmates at the 10-year high school reunion. There was no way I was missing the reunion. This was my victory lap, and I was just petty enough to take it. I was a few months shy of completing my doctorate and had fulfilled the promise of my senior designation in the yearbook, most likely to succeed. My friend Raina, one of the two mean girls from middle school, accompanied me. We had grown up around the corner from each other, ours a friendship born of necessity, since we were two of three black girls routinely taking honors courses together. It wasn't so much that we got along back then as that we needed each other to get along. We had weathered the storm of our teenage years, and with the angst and competition behind us, we had become real friends. We were a team on reunion night. Racial politics back home being what they are, there came a moment at the end of the homecoming football game, think Friday Night Lights, when the entire class decided to go out for a drink. Once we reach adulthood in the small town where I went to high school, black and white folks don't really socialize at the same watering holes together to any great degree. Raina and I stood in the bleachers watching our classmates split by race. We looked at each other wondering which group we should choose. The black kids hadn't been our friends, but the very Republican evangelical whiteness of our classmates wasn't as palatable as it had been a decade before. We figured we might as well throw our lot in with the blacks. So we went to a local restaurant for drinks. I threw back a couple of shots of tequila and started dancing to a hip-hop song blaring over the speakers. A new dance was out. And as is the custom of folks who are getting grown, we were trying to figure out who could, in fact, do the stanky leg. Lachey looked at me and said, "I want Brittany to do it." It was a gentle, mocking challenge, one designed to literally have me prove my blackness once and for all by standing up and dancing for the group. This bullshit again? Seriously? I'm not that drunk, I told Lachey. 10 years had helped my comeback game moderately. But since she had, I reasoned, started it, I refused to let it go. As our food came, I said to the table, "It's just so interesting that I'm here, because the narrative was that I wanted to be white back in the day." Lachey nodded. "That is true. People did say that." LaVon jumped in, hoping to keep the peace and not fuck up the vibe, saying, "Aw, you know we were just jealous." "Jealous? Jealous? Jealous." There was that word again, and I was as incredulous about it then as I had been years before, when my mama offered it as an explanation for the actions of April and her friends. April didn't make it to the 10-year reunion. She had died suddenly of natural causes a few days after giving birth to her daughter, during the fall of my freshman year of college. Thankfully, we'd made our peace the summer before I left, when I ran into her at Wendy's where she worked. She was a few months pregnant, and I was heading off to college. Somehow, we both moved along the trajectories that my town seems to set up for black girls. Either you become an exceptional achiever, or you settle into a life of low-wage work and children. Exceptionalism or struggle should not be the only pathways available to black people. When my mother talked about watching where those girls would end up, I know she had not, in fact, been thinking of April. April saw me, smiled, and said, "Hey, Brittany." I smiled back. Childhood beefs were squashed, and we were both moving into our respective paths of womanhood. Jealousy was the one emotion that I had never expected to hear. It had never occurred to me that the black children in my school knew there was something wrong with a system that singled out a few exceptional children and gave them the keys to the kingdom. I took a moment. Then I replied, "Man, I'm not holding on to it." We were all victims of a fucked up system. It chose particular kids and gave them everything. And it was set up to make us think that the white kids were so much smarter, while really, it was simply that they got more attention, more resources, and more opportunities. I don't blame y'all for that. These people in this town are racist. LaVon nodded her head, and we went back to drinking. Out in the car, Raina looked at me and said, "I don't agree at all with how you handled that. You left them off the hook, and they made our childhoods miserable." I had. And they had. Though Raina and I had grown up in the same neighborhood with single mamas hustling to make a living for us, we resolved the trauma very differently. For a long time, she took their internalized anti-blackness as evidence that there was little room for her in black communities. She gravitated toward white friends, multicultural Christianity, and conservative values. I went to Howard, found thousands of the overachieving nerdy black kids I'd been looking for, and healed because I began to experience a world in which smart black folks just made sense. I was able to see my childhood, the bullying, and small-mindedness as a function of retrograde racial politics that became magnified in the context of a small town in the semi-rural Deep South. More than that, I had learned the pitfalls of using a respectability framework to explain the achievement gap in our communities. Before going away to college, I thought other black children were lazy, unmotivated, and ignorant, and I ultimately concluded that they had gotten what they deserved. But at the reunion, LaVon offered me new insight. When she framed their childhood disdain toward me as jealousy, what I heard, more precisely, was an awareness of an injustice. Black children know when they are being left behind, devalued, and overlooked. Black communities have always been aware of the prickly politics of racial exceptionalism. W.E.B. Du Bois famously advocated for black communities to train what he called the talented 10th, an exceptional core of leaders who would get access to education and resources and bring them back to everyone else. More progressive black thinkers have long rejected the elitism of talented 10th-based leadership models. These models favor black folks who are polished, articulate, and easily able to acclimate to white environments. There was the pressing danger of talented 10th types returning to their home communities and looking down upon everyone else as unsophisticated, unintelligent, and self-destructive. But while Du Bois thought of this as a pragmatic strategy in a world where white people were not invested in being broadly inclusive, many of the blacks who came to have this kind of access felt entitled to it. Thus, part of the consciousness-raising process on the radical black left has been to be deeply suspicious of anything that looks like class-based entitlement. Moreover, young radical brothers, like the one who tried to convince me to move back to the hood, located their radicalism in the completion of Du Bois' strategy. It had failed because too many of us refused to go back. All would be well if the educated few would return and lend their talents to the struggling black masses. But liberation is never so simple as getting it and bringing it back. Any educated sister who sends a considerable chunk of her paycheck home to the folks who haven't yet made it out will tell you that we leave and return to the places that made us many times over the course of a lifetime. Still, our guilt over leaving people behind nips at our heels at every new station that we reach. For instance, whenever there is a convening at an academic conference, invariably some young radical person will get on the mic to ask, "Who isn't in the room? Who are we excluding?" These questions matter, but they can also be deeply annoying because very often they are a performance of middle-class angst. These people know full well who won't be at the conference before they ever sign up to come to it. How do we balance the impulse to think that having degrees equips us to speak for people in their absence with the fact that the degrees in most cases actually do mean we have something of value to contribute that we might not otherwise have had? My grandmother, who never finished high school, stayed on me to get my lesson because she knew there was something of value in the books I so loved to read. She knew it, and those of us who have read those books know it too. Why do we patronize people by acting like our access to more education didn't actually teach us anything of value? That's a patronizing lie we have to stop telling, for it serves no one and insults the very folks who made the sacrifices for us to get here. On one too many occasions, I have had social justice-oriented folks chide me for being elitist while they were diligently grinding their way through graduate programs at institutions far more elite than the ones I have attended. Part of what I am saying is that the anxiety about being inclusive is itself a middle-class black anxiety, a fear we have of getting too big for our britches, so to speak. Some of us handle our guilt by blaming it on God and his mysterious and divine favor and intentions. Others romanticize the very conditions they have spent their whole lives escaping. How do we deal with our guilt when we are the ones who achieved in a system that is intentionally set up for most black folks to fail? I don't know that I have the answer to that question, but I do know that we annoy the hell out of each other with assertions of our connections to various hoods and blocks and working class communities. An accusation that one is elitist is like the sounding of the death knell to any activist or scholar committed to the struggle. It's akin to somebody rolling up and dissing your mama. But there's a gender dynamic to it. When I have experienced these kinds of accusations from other black feminist women, typically it's mean girl shit and jealousy masquerading as a radical critique. When black men do it to black women, it is a way to deny black women the authority of being legitimate theorists or decision makers within black communities. The absurdity of this is that most of us are only 1.5 generations at most into the black middle class. The vast majority of educated black folks aren't that far removed from the mythic cousin Pookie whom Obama was obsessed with forcing off the sofa and into the voting booth. But President Obama's invocation of cousin Pookie, a stereotype signaling disengaged and disaffected young black men, was an intentional bid for street cred through an appeal to a cultural narrative accessible primarily to black folks. President Obama wanted us to believe that he knew a cousin Pookie or two himself. The ability to claim proximity to such folks is just one way that elite and middle class blacks index their continued insider status in working class black communities. It's highly problematic, mostly because it's performative, and not just on Obama's part. In other words, this kind of fronting doesn't help anybody. The sisters I know remain connected to their working class roots because the extra money we do make is often used to help somebody back home make the rent or car note, pay for Madea's light bill or medications, or just give whoever needs it a few extra dollars to tie them over till the next payday. Black women's consistent philosophy is, if we eat, everybody eats. If I'm not struggling, no one in my family struggles either. It is precisely this thinking that leads to black women my age having a median net wealth of $5. Favor isn't fair. So we should have what womanist theologians call a hermeneutic of suspicion, a healthy skepticism of the institutions and opportunities that would make of us exceptions. Relying on the favor of God to open doors for us is not a plan for systemic change or justice at any broad level. And using the favor of God to justify the machinations of a system that routinely forecloses opportunities for black women's thriving ain't revolutionary either. In fact, if this framework of favor goes unchecked, it lays the groundwork for an unholy trinity between the church, neoliberalism, and racial respectability politics. Black preachers point to the work of currying favor with God by obeying all the rules the Bible sets out because to them, God's favor is more powerful than any systemic obstacle. At their best, Christian invocations of favor are used as a resource in the fight against routine injustices that harm Black people and deny them access to opportunity. One problem, though, is that this approach to currying favor with God is individual. Second, it is wholly dependent upon the dictates of respectability politics to work. God apparently grants favor first and foremost to those who follow the rules. Those who tithe 10% of their income, those who don't have sex before marriage, those who attend church and Sunday school faithfully, those who don't think sinful thoughts, those who don't struggle with addictions of any sort, those who strive for perfection, and those who are always on their best behavior. It turns out that schools favor those who follow these rules too. In shorter form, success comes to those who take personal responsibility for their lives. But following the rules shouldn't be the guarantor of rights or dignity. Black children and Black people are told that if they simply follow the rules, they can make it into the middle class, where the hope is that they will experience some level of stability. When this respectability formula links up with Christian dogma about God's favor, one comes to believe that their access to a stable social life with the ability to pay their bills, have secure and affordable housing, healthy and affordable meals, good public schools, and a bit of discretionary income is a function of God's blessing and favor. Those who rely on God's favor to secure what the system cannot provide unwittingly admit that they know the system is a fraud. They know things are not set up for Black folks to win. But since God wants us to win as long as we do right, then theology becomes a substitute for demanding that the system be more just. In this way, the church, as I mentioned in my discussion of grown woman theology, has become complicit in the broader project of neoliberalism, which is marked by a social abdication of responsibility to create systems that help the vast majority of citizens achieve some notion of the good life. Instead, neoliberalism turns our attention to individual self-regulation and notions of personal empowerment as the pathway to having anything in life. And yet again, what we teach and preach in churches allows quote-unquote God language to do the dirty work of the system, namely, pretending to empower us while ultimately blaming our lack of social options on some flaw in our character or misstep in our conduct. I very much had to resist the narrative that I made it because I acted right. Racist teachers humiliated me and tried to break my spirit even when I acted right. Acting right, which far too often means acting white, didn't protect me from what Carol Anderson calls the white rage of my classmates when they realized that I actually would graduate at the top of the class and atop all of them. And plenty of Black children who acted right still didn't have the levels of opportunity I had. Part of the work of justice for those of us who made it out of terribly fucked up conditions is rejecting the myth of our own exceptionalism. That is the thing I tried to do at the table in the conversation with my classmates. I tried to find common cause with them, despite the traumas they enacted on me. Black people can do terrible harm to each other when we aren't clear who the enemy is. But in finding common cause, I also wanted to avoid doing harm to my community, to not participate in the narrative that stripped children who were just like me of having real educational opportunities simply because they didn't, for instance, show an early facility for reading. I wanted to forgive my childhood tormentors and at the same time to put some of the fancy educational analysis that I'd had the benefit of receiving to good and just use. The idea that the pathway to freedom is found in better choices is bullshit. Take, for instance, the latest research on the racial wealth gap. Anytime I'm in racial justice organizing spaces, at least one brother demands the mic so that he can tell us that what Black people need to do is support Black businesses. If we would just pull all our resources and stop spending money on Jordans and hair weaves, we could have real wealth to invest in our communities. The research says differently. Black people at every level spend less money than white folks in similar economic circumstances. It turns out that the entire respectability formula for raising Black socioeconomic status is a fail. Going to college, raising children in a two-parent home, working full-time, and spending less do not make it possible for Black people to close the wealth gap that they have with white people. White people have more money because their ancestors made money from owning our ancestors. When white people die, other white people gain wealth. When Black folks die, they often leave debt behind. When my grandmother died a decade ago, the bank let us know that she had a safe deposit box. We went expecting that there would be an insurance policy, a will, and other information about her assets. Instead, we found an unceremonious collection of 30-year-old receipts from the phone company. Grandmama took pride in paying her bills and in owing nary a debt. That was her legacy, that she died owing no one anything. So many Black folks aren't that lucky, and death often means loved ones inherit the debt of those who've passed on. In every generation, the vast majority of Black people must start over trying to build wealth. Sometimes they can only do that after they've resolved the debts others have left for them to handle. In order for people to make healthier, more sustainable choices that will support their thriving, they have to have better options. But the Hail Mary politics of divine favor, i.e. using favor like a Hail Mary, ain't about having more options, but rather about what happens when you have far too few of them. The hood is marked by a lack of access to reasonable options. It always annoys me to find out that the woke, radical, pro-Black, feminist position is uncritical valorization of the hood. Let me say this. If the people on the block had the answers, the revolution would have long since come. Disproportionate numbers of our people are locked in the structural hopelessness that attends concentrated poverty. Many of them dissent from that hopelessness every day by making a way anyway, by using their own ingenuity and will to create options for themselves where none exist. Being asked to do more with less is inhumane. Frequently, social scientists point to the resilience of children from difficult backgrounds. One time, in a meeting on my campus, in a discussion about the hardships children of color face, a white woman remarked dismissively, "Oh, but children are resilient." Celebrating the resilience of poor folks is a perverse way of acknowledging the unreasonable demands placed upon people who are already struggling to make it. In fact, in this moment, when a broad-scale conservative backlash threatens to absolutely gut the social safety net, resilience is a dangerous word. The logic of relying on people's resilience goes something like, "Let's see just how much we can take away from you before you break." That shit is evil. We can celebrate and recognize the awesome ways that Black humanity and possibilities show up without drinking the Kool-Aid. My mother is my shero. I'm the biggest beneficiary of her ingenuity and tenacity. But I don't mistake the model my mother carved for me for a liberation plan for all Black people. Nor is it reasonable to blame all the folks who didn't do what she did for their own social condition. You can't judge the effectiveness of a system by the success of its exceptional actors, from the president on down. So, what do we do when the woke position demands that we co-sign ways of thinking that actually don't make any sense? My entire life, my community encouraged me to leave and make something of myself. As soon as I achieved the highest possible credentials, suddenly lots of brothers, some with degrees and many more who didn't finish school, started popping up mansplaining that even though you might be more educated than me, that doesn't mean you have more knowledge than me. Some of the smartest folks I've ever known didn't have college degrees. As I've said, my daddy was the smartest man I never knew. I can throw a rock and hit an educated fool. But this suspicion of education and its benefits is part of a broader culture of American anti-intellectualism that we simply must reject. From age 4 to age 28, save 1 year, I was a student. 10 of those years were spent in pursuit of higher education. This counts for something. The 1 year that I wasn't a student, I worked at a public school. If I had already learned everything I would need to know in my community of origin, then all of the Black folks in that community would not have encouraged me to reach for the skies. Thus, when I see other radicals with elite access valorizing their hoods, I recognize it as misapplied survivor's guilt and a deep desire to retain one's street cred and authenticity. Whenever we're together, highly educated folks start doing this dance of talking about how we really need to appreciate what the hood taught us. I've done some of this dance myself, and much of it I believe in. Theorizing all the possibilities of resistance in crunk music and ratchet television is good, important cultural work, rooted in the working class sensibilities of the South. Appreciating the epistemological frameworks, the ways of knowing and making sense of the world that my grandmother and my mother bequeathed to me is radical work that upends the politics of the academy as the only place where anyone is saying anything of value. But the ignobility of academe doesn't make the hood noble. I gained the tools to do better analytic work and ask better questions in the university. I became a feminist in a PhD program. Hell, I learned the word epistemology in a PhD program. But more than all of that, I learned to heal from the anti-Black trauma and bullying that was the entirety of my childhood at college. The first day I stepped into Professor Lawrence Jackson's honors composition classroom was the first day of my life that I wasn't presumed to be the smartest black person in my classroom. Suddenly, I was in the middle of 360 degrees of black brilliance, and briefly, I was shook. Who was I if smart black girl fit fully 60% of the people on campus? Suddenly, I was no longer the only one, a truth I gulped down while I looked around the room at all the other eager students listening to Dr. Jackson's lecture about why the map of the world made Africa look so much smaller than everywhere else, when really, it was larger. The trap and the burden of being exceptional is that your entire identity is wrapped up in being the only one. The stories of infighting and competitiveness among blacks that we tell when we get together have everything to do with building an identity based on being the exception. It took exactly one day at a black college to break me of such thinking. It was both scary and exhilarating, but I came to understand the racial politics of U.S. public schools in my college and grad school classrooms. Those frameworks gave me what I needed to go back and see that my classmates and I had been victims of a system that pitted us against each other as a justification for its own logic of white dominance and black exceptionalism. American democracy is not interested in acknowledging that a Barack Obama can be found in every black community. I have met brilliant black boys at every step of my journey. Many of them were languishing in poor schools and even worse neighborhoods. Just like there are many, many white men who make viable candidates for the presidency, the same is true for black communities. The only difference is structural levels of access, not levels of talent or intellect. I would not have known that if I had not left my community. And despite what I know now, I still remember the loneliness of being a black girl nerd longing for community for most of my childhood. I forgive my bullies, but I don't want to live in any sustained community with them. Over the years, most of the specific incidents of harm have faded. But whenever I run into one of my old tormentors around town, typically, I know, because my stomach twists and turns into knots, recoiling at slights that have long since passed. That's a truth to sit with, too. The harm is no less harmful simply because we know what caused it. Structural violence is rooted in the need to maintain hierarchies, but far too often its most gut-wrenching acts are enacted horizontally by our peers, not by those positioned above us. Real radicalism implores us to tell the whole ugly truth, even when it's inconvenient. To own the hurt and the pain. To own our shit too. To think about it systemically and collectively, but never to diminish the import of the trauma. Survivor's guilt is about as useful as white guilt, which is to say, not useful at all. My mama worked too hard and my community prayed too much for me to feel guilty about making it. But I have copious amounts of rage at the systems that refused to nurture the talents of the kids who looked like me. And more than that, I have a great sense of responsibility. I'm not planning to go back home to live because where I'm from is no place for a radical feminist black girl who likes to challenge preachers in her spare time. But I am responsible in big and small ways for making that place and places like it better, more equitable, and more just. I'm thankful for favor, such as it is, but I refuse to mistake favor for freedom. Knowing more than the folks with less education than you doesn't mean you know everything. In some cases, it doesn't even mean you know the best things or the right things. But education is powerful. That is ancestral wisdom that our folks fought for us to have. We don't serve them well by acting like we don't know anything worth knowing. Going off to college and to grad school turned me into a picket sign carrying, Jesus-loving, radical feminist. I stand by the notion that the ideas I learned in those places and that all the things black feminism has taught me can help our folks get free. And for all those who would disagree, I would say simply, ain't no future in our frontin'. Joy. The term feminist killjoys is well earned. Sometimes, in the bid for rightness, feminist and hyper-woke folks can take the joy out of everything. I actually think it's irresponsible to wreck shop in people's world without giving them the tools to rebuild. It's fine to quote Audre Lorde to people and tell them the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. The harder work is helping people find better tools to work with. We have to smash the patriarchy, for sure. And we have to dismantle white supremacy and homophobia and a whole bunch of other terrible shit that makes life difficult for people. Rage is great at helping us to destroy things. That's why people are so afraid of it. But part of what I've been trying to say is that rage can help us build things too. The clarity that comes from rage should also tell us what kind of world we want to see, not just what kind of things we want to get rid of. I'm not interested in a feminist project that only works to tear down things. Black women know that justice is rarely found in the rubble. If your rage can do anything for you, I hope it can do for you what it has done for me. Help us to build the world we want to see. And since, as you know by now, I'm a church girl, I want to end this book in the way that I've watched Black preachers in church services my entire life. I want to offer you a benediction. My stepdad, a Baptist preacher and the first pastor I ever had, told us that we should never leave church without the benediction. Those good words spoken at the end imbued us with the power to go out and live out the things we had just learned about. So here goes. May you have joy. Joy, as I have heard countless Black preachers say, is different from happiness, because happiness is predicated on happenings, on what's occurring, on whether your life is going right, and whether all is well. Joy arises from an internal clarity about our purpose. My purpose is justice, and the fight for justice brings me joy. In your president's favorite book of the Bible, 2 Corinthians, these words appear. We are hard-pressed on every side, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not in despair. Persecuted, but not abandoned. Struck down, but not destroyed. In shorter form, the Black church would say, joy. The world didn't give it to me, and the world can't take it away. Maintaining the capacity for joy is critical to the struggle for justice. Things are still as fucked up at the end of this book as they were at the beginning. But we can't let the messed up state of the world steal our joy. It is critical in reinvigorating our capacity for new visions. When we lack joy, we have a diminished capacity for self-love and self-valuing and for empathy. If political struggle is exercise for the soul, joy is the endorphin rush such struggles bring. May you have gut-busting belly laughter every day. Laughing with my girls brings me joy. Traveling around the world, migrating down south to my mama's sofa, watching Food Network for hours, reading trashy romance novels, and watching sappy rom-coms, all of these things bring me joy. Yes, I know they reinforce the patriarchy. You win some, you lose some. May you ask more and better questions. Homegirl interventions leave me with more questions than answers, but usually they leave me with far better questions than I began with. May your curiosity be unceasing. May your rage be a force for good. What you build is infinitely more important than what you tear down. When the struggle feels unwinnable, may you never forget this one thing. You got this. We got this.
We hope you've enjoyed Eloquent Rage, a Macmillan audiobook from St. Martin's Press. Text copyright 2018 by Brittany Cooper. Production copyright 2018 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.